Hey, everybody, you're listening to the 234th episode of the Shop Talk Show, the one where Chris and Dave both wear suits to podcast. We have a lot to talk about in this episode, things from does atomic CSS, does it work? What do you think? What are your thoughts on atomic CSS? Is responsive web design, is it making traditional web design less important? And then thoughts about animating between pages of a website. We get asked lots of questions, but first I wanted to tell you about our sponsor this week. It is Media Temple, a longtime sponsor of the Shop Talk Show. Both Chris and Dave, myself, use it to host websites, so we're big fans of them. They've got a lot of things to talk about, but you know, it's a great service, and they really care about websites. So keep listening for that in the show. And for now, Dave, kick things off. Hello there, dear listener. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a very serious podcast about web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer. Chris, how are you today?
I'm so good. Actually, I'm struggling to breathe a little bit.
Yeah, so we're trying a little something different. This is our 234th episode, Chris. 234. We decided to wake up, celebrate, and put on suits, suit and tie. We got suit and tie. I'll take some photo snapshot evidence here.
I don't think people would believe it otherwise, but yes, indeed, Dave and I both are in suit and tie today, just to see if it would affect our show a little bit.
Yeah,
I don't know. Do you have a hypothesis?
I already feel about 100% more professional, so I think this is working. I think that we have just the right amount of pizzazz.
I might even answer the door if it rang instead of cowering in the corner.
Just letting your dog bark at the door.
But we are just going to do a regular rapid fire show where we answer a bunch of your questions, which I feel like honors the past of Shop Talk Show, because that's what we do.
That's what we're all about. And, you know, it would have been fun to, you know, get, you know, like 100 Paul Irish's or something on. But, you know, it's hard to coordinate people in the off season here. So let's jump into.
Well, I tell you, me and Dave had some grand ideas for the future of the show. So stay tuned. We have so many ideas.
Yeah, it's kind of just. I don't know, Chris. Let's talk. Let's talk shop. I've been having a lot of fun. I mean, we're 234 episodes in. I've been enjoying these rapid fires a little bit. It's kind of fun just to hang out and talk. I enjoy our guest shows as well. Like, we've had some killer panels and kind of introduced, like, I think every episode almost has had like three or four people on or two or three people at least. And so it's kind of fun to get kind of this has been like a broad perspective season. And then it's just been you and I talking a lot. So yeah, this is fun. I don't know, but we've also been kind of exploring what's been going on. Maybe we need to.
Well, what I'm most excited about, and no promises here, because I don't, you know, who knows how this will actually pan out. As Dave said, this actually takes quite a bit of work. Even to do the rapid fires takes work, let alone scheduling guests and editing things down and stuff, which we do very little of. Largely, we're one of those podcasts that just hits record, hits stop, sends it to our awesome audio guy, Chris Enns, shout out, and then we get it back and we publish the show with some notes. You know, it's not that hard. We're in a different category of podcast than the big podcast that like, you know, interview 10 people a show and stitch it all together and have a narrative and have all that stuff. And it's long been a dream of mine to do that kind of thing. And I think just maybe, again, no promises, we might take a stab at producing that kind of thing. And then when I said that to Dave, Dave's like, oh, I have at least two, three good ideas along that route. And I was like, wow, that is a good story we could tell. So I think we're both kind of excited about that.
And yeah.
Maybe we'll bring that to you in 2017.
2017 plans, laying the groundwork for season Is it? Gosh, it'll be there.
It feels like a good time to say, because we said we'd do something for 234. So let's make vague progress promises.
Yeah, vague promises for the future. That just what everyone wants for the special episode. So, Chris, it only makes sense to get into the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk show. Question and answer. Rapid fire. Pew, 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 pew. Shall we?
Just Call Me Mark writes in, who says, that's one I've definitely heard a bunch before. Mark, he's a freelancer. Just started as a freelancer, and he's, thinking about billing and stuff, which we get plenty of questions about. There are costs that you incur as a freelancer that are possibly billed in a different way than you bill your client. And Mark here is specifically asking about Typekit. He's using, custom fonts, as many, many people do, on a website that he builds for a client. He incurred that cost. How does he bill the client for it? How would you do it, Dave?
It's hard because you're like touching, you're probably like in 10 services. There's a Typekit. Maybe you're doing Hoffler fonts or something. You want project manage on Trello or something, and you're like tens of different things. Where do you draw the line on what the client pays for and what you pay for? My advice is always get the client to sign up for an account, log in, give their credit card.
That seems reasonable to me. Just talk to them. Be like, listen, one of the costs of a website is custom fonts. We feel strongly that these custom fonts are like really awesome on your website. That's part of what design is typography. And they cost money. They all do. So if it's okay with you, we'd like to, sign up for a service and we can walk you through it and we'll use your credit card to do it. And then that's it, now we can use, but you own it. This is something that you're responsible for. And that's because Typekit bills monthly or yearly. But I'm building this website. I'm only going to bill you once. Mm-hmm. So I can't put it on my credit card because I'm not going to spend 8 years of paying for your Typekit because I'm only kind of billing you once, Or be like, I'm just going to eat the cost because it's not that much money and that's just something I'm going to do. You can make that choice too, as long as you've kind of built it into what you're going to charge the client. Just be like, I don't know. The money is exchanging hands here. You just got to make the choice and do it and make sure that you don't eat it too badly,
Yeah, we jumped on a project recently and another agency had done it and they own the Typekit for the client. And so It was not, it's fine. Like people change, vendors all the time, but it's a little awkwardsville to like call the previous vendor and be like, hey, do you have the Typekit login? Because
or it's like the domain name problem too. Like try to have your client own the domain name. It's better for you and them.
Yeah. It's a clean break. Unless you want to be like a fully managed solution or something, but I think that costs money. Try to have a clean break, let them own what they need to own, or rent what they need to rent. That's I don't know. I think that's the responsible thing.
I think that's solid advice.
Mark.
We got a little bit of a brain twister from Paul Yabsley.
I love brain twisters.
Yeah, it's he sent a longer thing about it, and I've been kind of thinking about and distilling it down a little bit. But there is a code pen involved, so it's a little hard to mouth code pen things a little bit. But here's the gist of it, is that there's like – it's kind of like a two-column design. So like at any given point, the columns could be of different widths depending on how wide the entire viewport is of what you're looking at. But inside one of those columns is an iframe. Okay, so now you're in a situation where you want to write media queries for those two columns. Like at some point, one of those columns might drop below the other one or something. Like some significant event is going to happen. In his case, I think a bunch of padding changes when this media query hits. And then he wants to write some media queries inside that iframe that change at the same exact time as the ones the parent does. So it's kind of a weird situation because maybe not everybody knows this. I'm sure some people do, though. An iframe is its own viewport.
Yeah.
It's like its own little web browser inside of your other web browser. So what it thinks is the viewport size is different than the parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's kind of how CodePen works, right? It's an iframe inside of a viewport. So that's why my
my media
That's
queries.
True. And no, it's almost three iframes deep when you're looking at at a CodePen for sure. And so, yeah, so if you write a media query in CodePen, the width that it's based on or height or whatever other dimension is based on what's happening inside that iframe. But he's got another iframe inside that iframe. So let's say you wanted to write a media query that you know changed at the same time, both in the parent and the child. How would you go about it, Dave? Or would you just throw your hands up and say it's impossible?
No, it's not impossible. You're just in math town, USA, real hard. So if you're using like static padding, like pixel defined padding, let's say 10 pixels on each side, we're going to use like very round numbers. And so at 1,000 pixels is your breakpoint, and you have 10 pixels of padding on each side. Let's say 100, because that's a lot. That's not a lot of padding. 100 pixels of padding. So that iframe inside that container would be 800 pixels. So.
Oh, I see. But now you have to factor in the sidebar as well, because it's present. So you're saying you would try to solve this thing through just knowing on the parent at what size it is inside.
Yeah.
You can math your way out of this.
You'd have to like go from the big view port and then just subtract box models until you're to the size of the iframe, and then write your iframe media query to match that. Where it gets tricky now is percent padding. Like, because you're going to get, 56.842 pixels, and so you'll have to like size the browser exactly where you want it and then kind of make your determination on the pixel sizing. So like,
I would think if it's simple enough that is how I would approach it too, just kind of like write different media queries inside the iframe that through math match up with the parent ones. I'd like, I'd give that a shot. But as soon as it got very complicated, I would start with some cross iframe communication stuff. So, Paul, if you own, if this iframe is on the same domain as the other one, which I think in your case it was, that opens up some communication possibilities from inside that iframe and out. What do they call that? Post message?
Yeah, post message. So you can say, you can have the document like say, hey, iframe, I did this. And then the iframe will say, okay, I'll apply this class or remove this class.
Right. So I might write them as media queries on the parent page, but inside the iframe, I would just have some JavaScript listening for those post messages that say, "Hey, the parent just changed media queries." And you can how do you test media queries in JavaScript? It's like
window.matchmedia.
Match media. There you go. As soon as the match media call backfires, send a post message down to the iframe saying that media query triggered, and then apply a class or something that changes it. That way, it's like, it's locked in, man. It's like, it's sending information around about what's happening. You're not trying to like keep math in sync in two things.
Yeah.
It's like you're reacting to callbacks. Feels like more a programmatic way to handle it.
One other thing, give up. Is that an option? Give up on trying to make them in sync? Because one cool thing you have here is you have basically a container query. You have the element query in the iframe. So like make that document in the iframe, like make it perfect and then
responsive to itself. Just make it do what it wants to do based on how wide it is. Yeah, I totally agree with that too. I suspect there's something deeper going on here.
Like a background color matching or something.
Yeah. Which, that's literally what the demo is doing. So,
yeah. So there's probably, reasons you'd want to, kind of be very terse, I guess, is that's the right word. You want them to be matchy-matchy. But I would try to let that content in the iframe be its own thing. I would try to divorce those.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Because you kind of have the best situation for responsive media queries. That content can media query to itself. So I would do that if you could. But, it's not always easy. So, all right.
I kind of forget what seamless iframes are. Do you even remember what they are? It was like a thing.
Remember that? I forget, man. I
think styles like cascade into them or something.
Yeah. Is that right? And then so.
Nah, let's not. We're shooting from the hip here.
Hey, shooting from the hip. That's why you listen to the Shop Talk Show episode 234. Coming at you live. Tom Evans writes in, hey, so lately I've been trying to improve the build automation where I work. Currently I'm playing around with NPM running scripts for each task because currently Grunt and even Gulp are quite slow on very large projects, and I I'm thinking NPM might be faster. The issue I have is I want to make this as simple as possible for people setting up a project. For this reason, I would love to have a config file that people could simply update the folder paths and et cetera. And then that would update the NPM scripts, meaning they don't actually need to know how the code works. But currently, I can't find a way to do this. I did try referencing a JS file for each task, but ran into issues for stuff. And then line node SAS completing for stuff. Node SAS completing the compile, but not creating the compiled file. Okay, so it did the SAS, but it did not create the file. I figured this out by using VS Code Debugger. Your ideas, thoughts on how this could be achieved on the speed differences in front end task runners would be great. Thanks. So
there's a lot going on here. It's kind of like I want to switch my entire build process because my current build process has an error or isn't doing what I expect it to do.
Well, yeah, I don't want to oversimplify, but it seemed like Tom didn't like Grunt, so he wanted to switch to NPM scripts, and then he wrote little config files to configure those NPM scripts. And in my mind, you sort of just reinvented Grunt to some degree, right?
Does sound like that a bit.
I don't know. Like NPM scripts is awesome. I've been using it in my quest to get rid of dependencies. But you almost have to kind
of... What you get rid of, the point is NPM can literally run, it has its own type of script, mm-hmm. right? And you can, in your package.json, you can define them. And it literally is just like, I don't know, if you want to have NPM run Dave... You in your package.json, you say scripts, and scripts is an object, and Dave is a name of one of the
key-value
pairs in there. Mm-hmm. And then you just put some stuff in there that you would run in Node. It would be like run SAS or whatever.
Yeah, it puts a picture of me in your command line. So that's the ultimate.
And the idea is the only dependency there is Node and NPM.
Yeah.
There's nothing on top of that. You don't also need gulp, and you don't also need... So you've kind of like... removed one, there's still quite a few dependencies going on here. It's not like you are down to bare metal here, but you gotta use Node and you gotta use NPM. So since you have to use those anyway, you might as well stop the complexity there.
Yeah. So you could do, where I'm doing it is like, you know, maybe it's, NPM, run, build client, and I'm webpacking the client file, and then npm build server, and I'm webpacking the server, and then I create, and these are kind of like shortcuts, aliases in bash, where you can,
and it's just as fast as it would be if you typed that command into the command.
Yeah,
line,
it's right? Just
that is all it's doing.
It's just a shortcut. I don't have to like type the -c, you know, colon webpack server js or whatever. I just type npm run build server, and then I have another task, npm run build, and that will build the client and the server. So I've like now I've got a shortcut that links to two shortcuts. It does two shortcut jobs. I like that. I think it's fun. I think you do kind of hit this like, what the heck is going on sort of phase. But it's pretty cool.
I can see the point of it. I because it's kind of like, let's say you want to use a build tool like Gulp and you want to then use some Gulp plugin to run that thing like SAS or something or Stylus or Webpack or whatever. All that Gulp plugin is doing is like making a loose like API wrapper around the package that just runs on Node anyway. So whoever created like Gulp SAS or whatever, they have a bunch of command line things, or you know, like -- compressed or whatever. And so the Gulp plugin just like makes a little API around that. But this is like, no, I'm not going to use their API. I'm just going to use the tool exactly as it was designed. The entire world of the original tool is available to me. But I can't write out those commands by hand every single time because I'm not going to remember them, and that's just not a smart computer's thing to do. I'm just going to write those commands down in my package.json file and just have them run. So it's not like, oh. I don't know. I'm sorry if I...
No, you're exactly right. It's like, it's kind of like you're just shortcutting like a task runner. Task runners make this easy. These are just the raw.
It's commands. Almost like giving your own like a bash shortcut or whatever in your...
Yeah, it's pretty killer. But I guess for Tom's thing, like he switches from project to project. He wants somebody to like set variables. The only thing I could figure you could do like would be set like a bash environment variable. So like whatever env bracket path to SAS file, and it's like a relative path or something. You'd have to like create environment variables that you ship around.
Yeah. I mean, can that just be like a random like env.js file sitting there that something reads?
Yeah, there's a package manager called .env, or maybe it's called .dot.env npm. I'm live Googling here. Yeah, .dot.env. Yeah. Rails and I guess Node have this, and it's just kind of a JSON key value pair. And you could have it, you'd have to
So it's yet another dependency, but not a very deep one, right? It's just kind of a standardized format.
Yeah. Exactly. It's kind of like just a standard format. You'd have to kind of open this and load it. And that would be, I don't know how you do that from NPM scripts. I mean, in theory, it's possible. You just say like whatever require.env env load, but you'd have to enter a node process. So so I guess it'd be node require. I can't. My brain isn't going to do this on the first try. So, but that .env would be kind of a semi-standard way to do that, to like load up these config variables. So.
Well, interesting stuff. It's a little above my head, but I can see how that's interesting here. We have some anonymous ones that written. I used to feel weird about that, and now I feel better about it. Like, I don't really care if you write into us anonymous. It's still a good question, right? And I'm sure people have plenty of good reasons to write in anonymously. So if you'd prefer to do that, you just go ahead and go for it. One of these anonymous people wrote in, how do you manage the web development process? Pretty broad question. I feel like I'm at a constant battle between a good product and satisfying my boss in terms of hours spent, and the client in terms of visual progress along the way. Once the design is approved, this anonymous person wants to focus on the back-end code and the core functionality of what they're going to build before we style everything, whereas my boss and or possibly the client is often looking for visual progress. Is this merely a communication area? Have you experienced something simpler? So this anonymous person thinks that, like, you know, once they've kind of, you know, gone through the early stages of this project, the only thing that the boss and or client is responding to is, like, you know, new UI.
Yeah.
Is this...
Yeah,
which I feel like I'm guilty of that. Like I tend to not ooh and ah at sometimes at new work until I can like see it working, until the UI is done.
Yeah, no, I think this is a thing, and it, you have to kind of put yourself in the client's shoes, their perspective. Like they can only get excited about things you can show, you know. So that's why like a 30-minute JPEG is, I think, as Anonymous here said, is more interesting than 8 hours of just cutting edge PHP, you know, really awesome optimization. But in a way, you know, maybe that's a screenshot. Maybe you're just like, okay, here's what it loaded in. You know, this is a screenshot of the network panel in Chrome, and here it is after, like, I did a before and an after, and here we go. Like, it's,
you know,
so
what?
Much faster.
I love it.
I mean, you have
that's
to
so smart.
You need like visual artifacts, especially if people are visual learners. That's the other side of like client services. I think I'm kind of understanding now in my like 20th year of building websites, is like, some people, you know, what is it? We learned it in like elementary school. Some people are auditory learners, visual learners, what's the one where you have to write it down like a mechanical or something learner, but you like so people like respond in different ways to different things. So you have to kind of figure out like what this particular person, this stakeholder really likes. And usually it is probably these visual like design bumps, like this went from an A to a B. What do you think? And they can respond to that. But when you're like, this PHP went from 8 lines of code to 4 lines of code, they're just going to be like, cool, man. Like, that it's better. You know, they can't really have an opinion, but a lot of people can have opinions on visual design for better or for worse. Is that how it works at CodePen? Are you the...
Well, that's what I'm thinking of and almost trying to look for examples. I work with Tim Sabat. He's one of our big server guys in DevOps and just does a lot of, like, and kind of, you know, somewhat rarely works on UI stuff. But I think Tim is really quite good at showing us what he's done and not just being like, you know, I don't know, when we have a meeting and people are showing off new UI bits and there's little GIFs of new things that we're building going on in Slack and stuff. Instead of Tim just like feeling sad and left out of that stuff, Tim is always on the job of posting like graphs from AWS or whatever, usage stats or like bugs closed or his personal checklist of things that are checked off or, you know, GitHub issues that are closed out or whatever. He'll show us like, oh, this is what I did today. Or I did some server work and see this big line. Now it's dropped way down over here because of the work that I did. You know, he's always showing us that stuff. And I guess I'm always like, cool. That's just his way of taking part of it. But I think there's more to it than that. It's this that's going on. This anonymous person could benefit from that. People need to, you know, like you said, Dave, a visual artifact of
progress, like just showing some kind of progress heading towards some kind of goal. So,
yeah. Sorry, the footer isn't done. I made the CMS work, you know?
Yeah. Or like, I didn't polish the footer to pixel perfection, but man, I kind of figured out your whole data model. I mean, that's how do you quantify that? But it's hard, but it is important. So I think anything you can show to how you fix that or whatever, I think that's good. So screenshots help, charts and graphs help. Those are visual things, right? So I like the just like showing your checklist, like here's my, you know, you could even call it like, here's my nerd list. These are nerdy things I'm doing that you won't see, but here's kind of my checklist as I go through them. That's kind of a cool artifact. So, all right. How's your suit fitting, by the way? I might need to bump up my AC a few hundred degrees.
So. I keep looking at myself because we're doing it by video, which we never do, but we're doing it through video. And I'm like, God, I look good in this suit.
Dang.
I might go out for fancy lunch after
sharp
this.
Dressed man. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Spill some mustard on it.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, don't brush your teeth. Don't put the shirt on until after you brush your teeth because Ace Dave Rupert move is just toothpaste falls out of my mouth onto the
gone.
Yep. All right. Hey, Ollie wrote in, I feel a little reluctant to include open source, material
to include open source material
in something I would present to a possible employer. Is this hesitation justified? Interesting. My instinct is to build examples of what I have learned with HTML, CSS, JavaScript, PHP, Java from the ground up in a somewhat hello world fashion and use this as an example of my ability.
That doesn't sound unreasonable, you know. I think Oliver may have expanded on this, and I just cut it short for the podcast reasons. Or maybe we've had other questions similar to this. I can't even really remember. But like, well, let's say I made this awesome website. Like I made the accessibility project has a new look these days. But when V1 of it shipped, it was Bootstrap, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep.
Like if you made that, and you did all that work, and we were a part of that effort, as you were. Would you and you were looking for a new job? Would you show somebody in an interview, look at this thing that I mailed? And but be worried that you were showing up because you used Bootstrap for the design? I would say no. I'd be like, dude, I know I used Bootstrap for it. I'm aware of that. It wasn't really about that.
It's yeah,
about the content.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, what's the goal of it? I hesitate to like say, yeah, make everything from the ground up. That's super inefficient, actually. You know, you should use some sort of whatever plugin framework that somebody else wrote. If it suits your needs, you know, I'm not going to rewrite picture fill every time I deploy a website just because I want to show somebody I know how to write my own picture fill. It's like, no, just use the like standard tool and, you know, save your client hundreds of dollars to do it the already, you know, established way. I'm trying to think of like what, you know, I do like if it's something, you know, is somebody who just like knows how to smash together a bunch of NPM modules. Is that, you know, has no idea what's in them.
Yeah, but you'd hate for them to get more credit than you because you tried to roll from scratch. So I'd say it if you, I don't know, just be clear about it. Like if you did some like really basic hello worldy feeling thing, but it was actually kind of awesome and you used like no dependencies and learned all this stuff from scratch. And if I was showing that to an employer, that's what I would tell them. I'd be like, hey, I'm kind of aware that I could have pulled in about 15 modules to kind of get this thing done, but I chose to build this from scratch just as kind of a test, an example of my own ability. And maybe here's another example. Like my blog, I used a WordPress theme on that I thought was pretty cool. So that's obviously a cooler finished product, but I'm capable of ground up work as well.
Right. I think that would be, and for me, if I was hiring or something, you know, it'd be, I think with like PHP as the example, it'd be like, well, why didn't you use Laravel? Like that's the hotness or right now. So why didn't you, I guess is would be my question. And if you have a good answer to that, that's great. But it, like you said, like I wanted to do it from the ground up, have like a firm understanding. I felt like I could learn more that way. That's an awesome answer. But if it's just like, oh, I don't like it, I want to be code commando, I would be like, that's a minus point, you know? I don't know.
Good question, Oliver. I would just, you know, it's one of those things where just communicate what you're doing. I don't think there's any particularly wrong answer here, but I definitely wouldn't be like, I can't possibly show a client anything that I've used any dependency on.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything's a dependency, man. It's turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Media Temple. That's mediatemple.net. Hey, Media Temple has some news. Maybe you're familiar with one of their hosting plans called The Grid. Super powerful, super popular. They have some changes to The Grid. For one thing, it got cheaper. For just $20 a month now, they have The Grid Personal Plan. 100 sites, 100 databases, 20 gigabytes of all SSD storage. That's awesome. You know, I was on The Grid for a long time. I feel like 100 sites is like a ton of sites. If you're just like a personal developer doing freelance stuff for people, managing your own site stuff, you can get it all on this package just for $20 a month, which is great. If you get anywhere near limiting or maxing that out, you can upgrade then to their pro plan, which is just $30 a month, and you get 5x all of that. 500 sites, 500 databases, 100 gigabytes of storage. You get one of them on a CDN, which is great. Put your most, you know, the one that needs the most speed on the CDN. There's one site of malware detection, automatic removal, which is great. 1,000 email boxes and all this for just $30 a month on their pro plan. They have an agency plan as well for $150 a month that 5X is all that. So it's like really impressive, powerful, lots of hosting for very good prices. That's all at mediatemple.net. Nick Lemon writes in, oh, masters of the shop, I wanted to get your opinion on the seemingly controversial use of single-use classes on the web. I recently listened to the RWD podcast featuring the devs over at Marvel. There's a link to that in the show notes. I haven't been able to get the idea out of my head since. So apparently they're using it. Marvel's using these single-use classes. They claimed on the episode that their style sheet is 3 kilobytes when gzipped. That's pretty small. Are single-use classes a good way to go for a large shared code base? I work for a large company with multiple front-end devs on each project, and the more I look at our growing style sheet, the more I feel like this is the way to go. Why declare width 100% on multiple distinct components when I could just add a width-100 class to the markup? Why declare margin 2M over and over and over and over when we could just use the class mg-med? I know kernel standards would be horribly offended by the lack of clear separation. I'm not sure he would, you know. Kernel standards. You can use whatever class names you want. That's perfectly standard.
The computer doesn't speak English. That's irrelevant.
I don't see any rules being broken here whatsoever.
No, actually, I think kernel standards would like disapprove of any unsemantic markup whatsoever. If you even mess up a little bit, he's going to crack the whip. It's not. Yeah.
This is related a little bit to even the inline styling React panel that we had in a way. Mm. And there's more and more people choosing some kind of version of this out there, whether it's a build process doing it or whether you actually write these classes yourself in CSS in which to reuse them. I think it's common, like one of the most popular commonly referred to things is atomic CSS that's worth looking up. Dave, you should even go to sports.yahoo.com right now and look at, you know, just inspect element on something and you can kind of see what I believe is officially atomic CSS at work. And there's tons of like really weird class names in there for you to look at. And I think the way this particular one works, maybe, or at least how some of them work out there, is that you use all these classes, then you run it through a build tool, and it actually makes the minimum amount of CSS necessary to cover all the classes that you've used. So just because you see something in here that says FZ parentheses 17 pixels, which let's see, that's font size 17 pixels. It doesn't mean that there's 100 of those classes that cover every possible pixel size from 1 to 100. It just has the ones that you did use in your CSS, which is one of the reasons why the CSS can be so small, is because you've moved some of that size over to the...
Can I read HTML a class function. Name from Yahoo? Sports.yahoo. This will be an interpretive reading for our 234th episode. This is on the buzzing on Yahoo kind of feature banner, like a little alert banner. Div class capital D parentheses TB space B capital B DRS parentheses 2px capital W parentheses 100%. Capital B XZ parentheses BB capital WHS parentheses N capital P start 0 capital PY XP 8px capital P end 11M.
The irony here feature gradient doing one. This is that
data React ID
that's probably supposed to be the human readable size of this, and I'm not saying that it's not. But that stuff that Dave is reading, that's what you as an author write, and that's what is expected that other people look at and read. And I don't think it's that like capital B, G, C, you know, when we say it like that, it kind of feels like, what is that? But if you're looking at it in the dev tools, you're like, oh, I see, it's background color.
Right.
W is width. Right. And color is, you can use variables in there and stuff. So it feels weird to say, and it's actually extremely easy to make fun of, I think. But like it does have there's a world in which this isn't crazy for sure. And I know literally lots of smart people who are behind this. So the days of me making fun of this and thinking it's stupid and or saying anything negative about it at all are over. Because I think there's lots of people having lots of success with it, and I really don't care.
I see the attractiveness. I am not attracted to it. If that, no. like I feel like you are pulling, you know, you're pulling maybe some collision and cascade problems out of your CSS. I think that's good. I do like class-based, you know, utility classes, but I sort of feel like this is the extreme version where it's just a lot of utility classes. And I don't know, you're putting a lot more stuff into your markup, like into your HTML now. Is that good? Is that bad?
Yeah, it's tough, and we can say stuff like, "Oh, well, how do you deal with media queries?" Then it's so weird to say with 100%. What does that even mean? What is this with at different media queries? I think they all have answers for that stuff. So
yeah.
I'd hate to.
Well, I'm just kind of like, I think it's fine. I think it is cool that I think it's a good thing. But I think I just for me, I don't think I could get behind it. I think it would be really hard to onboard people onto a team and kind of get all these classes. I mean, you run into that with normal classes, I guess. Maybe it is easier, but with normal classes, you know, it's like this is sparkly feature hero action hero. And, you know, so you have to know that class, like read through this 1,000-line CSS file and find that class. I mean, that's hard too. So I guess you're just kind of putting together your own mutant classes and it works. Yeah. Okay. I don't know.
It's tricky. I just, you know, when you see people have success for something and feel strongly that they love it, and then you see them ship products with it and stuff.
So when people are having success with things, Chris, you tear them down.
This is awful.
This is a horrible thing.
I can say that it doesn't appeal to me that much. But I feel weird internally about it, because it's like I've felt this way about lots of things in the past and then came to a moment where I started to understand it and then got behind it. So it's like, why haven't I jumped on this bandwagon yet? Maybe I would love it. I don't know. I can't tell the future. I think I'll just have to wait for a project where it felt a little more correct on it. And that time in my life is not right this second. So that's just the way it is. Sorry, you know. I'm not afraid of it, though. I would potentially try it on something, maybe.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I kind of like I need to style a new thing. Interesting. I wonder if there's something else, like an existing pattern that I could go off. Oh, there is. Let me make a variation for it. Maybe I'll just use it as it is. Oh, there's nothing like this. Let me come up with a smart name that fits into the general naming convention that we have going on. And I'll just write regular old CSS that accomplishes what I need to do. I feel pretty good about that. Like, I'm good at that. That's one of the...
Yeah, I mean, you can, like, you're just kind of... Rather than having like a module in your CSS, you're just having a lot of classes in your HTML that make a module. Maybe it works. Maybe it ad hoc moduling. That's what they should call it.
I think their modular CSS is another name for it, actually.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, so yet another answer on Chop Talk Show where it depends.
That's why you listen.
We get to talk about it for a little bit. And that wouldn't be we certainly wouldn't rule that out. I think... to have another episode on that. That's not just the React-based one, although I think this Yahoo Sports example that we brought up is React, but it doesn't have to be. And there's articles on CSS Tricks about it as well, about non-React versions of this as well, that I can put in the show notes. Hmm. But let's do another one. Let's see. How are we doing with time? Now that we have the suit and tie on, it's like,
is time going business, faster? Business, slower? Chris. Oh. We got
all the time.
I got a hard stop. So we're doing hard stops.
You hear that word a lot.
All right. Another question from Anonymous writes in, I am wondering if traditional web design is becoming less important. Ooh, hot drama sound effect. I started feeling this way a few years ago. With RWD, designers don't create a new design, but we just pick a design pattern. Sometimes I wonder if my clients will have just as much success if they use something like Squarespace. Last year, I was worried about being a web designer, so I decided to learn more about app design. I thought there would be more design work there, but after I launched my first app, I was amazing how little design was involved in making an app. I would say I spent 90% developing and 10% designing. Is there just less digital design work nowadays? This is a good question, Chris.
It is. I think we could ignore like the Squarespace part of it. That's kind of a different issue. But this is the issue that certainly there's been people thinking about and talking about, is that like, is RWD killing design kind of thing? That's where my mind goes to with this. And that like, you can't be as creative and then when you throw performance in there as well, it's kind of like the web is really like rewarding really, really simple design with really, really simple typography that doesn't do a lot of crazy variants. It's like anytime you do anything crazy, all it's doing is adding weight to the page and adding complexity, and forget that. And, you know, it makes it harder to manipulate to different screen sizes. So I think there's some of that is going on. And some of that is like this, it makes our job a lot easier if we don't try to get real weird and fancy with the design. And sometimes you do it and you get snake bit because something really does go wrong at some different screen size or something. And you're just afraid. So there's some, you know, some trend towards simplification, I think, if you looked at lots of years in a row. Certainly web design doesn't look like the Space Jam website anymore, where kind of anything goes. But that isn't because RWD, you know, like you, people are making those choices for lots of complex reasons. And just because responsive web design exists doesn't mean that like the creativity is dead. I mean, those are like, there's some logical fallacy happening there. I'm not sure what to call it, but like you can be as creative as you want. You, if you're bored of boring design work, don't do boring design work.
Yeah, I would divorce RWD from this. I think it's a common like, oh, RWD, soulless web design, blang. And it's, that's my least favorite discussion on the web. RWD is a response to the very real problem that mobile traffic is now over 50%, like on most news and most websites. It's like our, like mobile has exploded. RWD is a response. It's a tool to kind of maintain your one website for this. Otherwise, we would all be maintaining mdots and tdots and watchdots and, you know, every like and desktop dots and Xbox dots and hologram dots. And we'd have RWD is the response to that. And it's a tool to make like it work on the multi-device web. That said, I sort of agree, and we don't want to be bummers on our 234th episode. This is a very special episode. We are wearing very fancy suits. But I had a friend over dinner, and we were talking about the web and the current state. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of, I don't know if you've read like Sazzy's post on like the client service well kind of drying up and things like that. And we were just talking about it. And one thing my friend said, and I don't know if he wants to be quoted on this, so I won't say it, but, or I won't say who it is, but he said, you know, maybe web design is a solved problem. And I was like, whoa. And like, that was eight months ago he said that to me. And now I'm just like, wow, maybe, you know, UX and UX research like achieved its goal. And we like found all the patterns that work, and we found everything, and almost everything works. And it's good for the users to have similar patterns and similar kind of flows. You know, it's bad for creatives and standing out, but you know, that's up to your organization, whether you want to zig when everyone's zagging. So, but it's interesting. Maybe, you know, the conventions have developed to where this is kind of a result of being a mature industry. And you, Anonymous here mentions like went into app design and, you know, I assume that's like native app design. All native apps that's even more planned out for you than the web. You use this view and you use this component in this view and this thing, and material design is like these are your shadows even. Like,
designers really appreciate that. You know, I don't know. I would think a good designer, like, you know, the core of why you're a designer is to make something that's really usable, that people understand and they're productive with when they use your product, and they, you know, you're making the business money and you're making people happy and stuff. And sometimes just, you know, what's the classic thing? Like, what's a handle on a teapot? A design affordance? We got yelled at the other week for you saying the word affordance too many times.
Oops.
But that's part of the deal. You know, a designer sometimes use affordances because it makes their apps better.
Yeah.
That's the only reason you'd use an affordance. And it's like, just because it doesn't like spin and twirl and have a rainbow on it. I know that's awful to say, because you're not talking about that, I realize, Anonymous. You're talking about just, I don't know, more visual flair of any kind, I guess.
But that comes at like a cost to the user, it turns out, you know? I mean, it's an interesting, you have to kind of make good choices. I think that's where, that's what will determine good and bad web design is like, did you make a good choice? And, you know, how well was it implemented? There is like hope. Here's what I will say. There is hope. You know, Instagram is a great example. They were kind of the first ones to put the camera button in the middle of the thing of the app. And that, like that one decision made it very easy to take a photo and share it. And they, you know, got acquired for billions of dollars. Snapchat, kind of the next iteration, you open that up, you're in the camera, like basically, like that's, you know, they kind of made it even easier to get into the camera and in the kind of core functionality. So I think that's sort of the, like what I think that's maybe the like thing is, how do you make something, how does your design like make it easy to do the one thing that people came to do, you know? How can you?
Well, you can take some pride in that. Hopefully, that you can consider that good design as well.
Yeah, yeah, but like visually, components, patterns, kind of a solved problem. And I hate that, but it is, you know, there's only so many ways you can like draw a list view of things. You know, it's either like a like search results page, or it's like a grid of thumbnails, or it's
kind of like it. Like I'm way more like design is interesting, and I'm a part of that world, and I like it. But I love it when design can be solved and not, you know, or be close to solved and be out of the way so that we can work on the idea. You know, that's part of the startup mantra too. Is like just do the minimum you can so that you can focus on the thing that your business has value with. You can focus on your writers doing good writing and good journalism. You can figure, you know, your app to help people sell widgets at a store. You know, focus on the value that you're providing and get the design out of the way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, how do you make the content good? You know, how does that happen? And maybe that is like heaps of design and flourishes and, you know, gradient buttons, you know, but like, what does that mean? What? I don't know. It's interesting. If you're interested in alternative web design, Jen Simmons has that labs.jensimmons where she's kind of messing with, you know, future tech CSS and stuff. Check that out. I think she's doing kind of cool ways to kind of beef up content and also kind of shake up our normal way of websites. So I would recommend
very that. Good point. And specifically layout, and that in these things can still be successful or possibly more successful by getting more interesting. Maybe we can do one more. We have Nico Fanjul, who is wondering about, here's a design thing. I have lots of clients asking for sites with animations and site transitions. I researched a lot, and the closest thing I found for transitioning between pages without refreshing the page was something called Barba.js, which I did look up. It looks kind of sweet. I think I couldn't quite implement it. Have you heard of anything like that? Also, they wanted to an animated preloaded logo that positions itself after the site is in its natural position, the top right corner. That's a pretty specific thing, but we're talking the base of this question is about transitioning pages without refreshing the page. So there's a lot, you know, there's so many ways to talk about this. There's ways to shoehorn it into existing sites that didn't have it. There's this whole concept of an SPA these days, a single page web app that, because there's so many advantages to that, there's a lot of sites that are built specifically with that in mind. It looks more like Barba is a way to kind of to shoehorn it into a site that isn't naturally an SPA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of just a loader that loads the page and then injects it, I suppose. Sort of what,
but then does all the weird hard stuff for you too, because it's kind of like, so you want to change the page, right? And you have 1.html, 2.html, and 3.html. You've done nothing. There's no JavaScript fanciness going on at all. And you want a link to click from 1 HTML to 2 HTML, but you don't want to refresh the page. Okay, well, there's going to have to be JavaScript involved. You're going to have to Ajax for 2.html and get the entire contents of it. Then you're going to need to drop it on the page somehow. But Barba is like, well, okay, you can do that. Or you might as well be fancy when you're doing it, you know? You might as well wait until the Ajax call is done. You might as well get that new content, pull the old content out in an interesting way, drop the new content in an interesting way. And then not only that, but change the URL when you're done. And make sure that, you know, like when the page is reloaded, that it goes to the right place, which I think is actually easier with Barba.js because you've architected your site to, you know, to be based on those.
Yeah.
URL.
Well, it looks like Barba's using Pjax, which is like how GitHub does its pages. It's like an old Rails technology. it's basically it just queries 2.html and then grabs the like div under the body, or it grabs a certain div. Like,
yeah, that way it doesn't need to, you're not replacing like the doc type and the head and all that stuff. You're just replacing a chunk of the, like the body, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So it should be pretty, I don't know. I'm curious in this too. I mean,
I bet you could inject it into a WordPress site too. There's, you know, no, I just 100 years ago, I did a screencast about that. I was like, hey, with jQuery, you know, jQuery supports grabbing content from a URL, and you can even give it a CSS selector to only grab the content from that area. There's no reason. It's actually like four lines of JavaScript to like, you know, click a link that's, it happens to be an internal link, go grab the content from that URL, replace the body with it, update the URL. Mm-hmm. It's like a pretty easy thing to shoehorn in with a couple of lines of JavaScript.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why I don't do this. The reason I think I don't is because, I mean, on a slow connection, like a loader going all the way across, just crawling across the screen, that's frustrating. I don't know why I don't do this. I Paravel has a very simple portfolio website, and
it's just not any faster. It's still got to go across the network to get that in the entire guts of that entire page.
Yeah, the only
thing, it's like, well, I don't know. It's adding a weird thing that,
yeah,
entirely.
You maybe get
unless you're to do a cool transition.
Yeah, you maybe get like a cool transition out of it, and I think that's kind of what's interesting. I've been like thinking about the Paravel website. It's very like simple static click through. It's Jekyll. But I was kind of like, you know, what if like there was a bit more, I don't know, emotion,
pizzazz,
yeah, pizzazz, client pizzazz, you know. But then if I do that, all the clients will ask for that. So whoops. So and I don't know. I think if it's like seamless and automatic, that's great. But yeah, there are framework tools. Like React kind of does this, you know. Just because the way it injects things, you can apply a transition for when things go in and out. Ember, I've seen a demo where Ember has like a Ember Fire, I think is what it's called, like a plugin that'll just like switch between your views. And because you're using Ember, it knows what to do. So there's.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. And yeah, you know, it's actually like single page web apps actually have a harder time dealing with it than it would be if you built the entire site out with just like normal HTML and CSS and stuff, or a CMS, because a single page web app needs to like digest the URL and make sure that it serves the right stuff, both on the client side and on the server side, in the case that, you know, the framework didn't load or whatever, which means that's actually quite tricky, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I actually like the approach of just building a normal website, you know, that just works, and then enhancing it with something like Barba.js. Looks pretty cool to me.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I don't know if somebody's got a good cheap way to do fancy effects. Let us know in the comments, Chris. I think it's that time. We look good.
I'm gonna loosening my tie. I'm loosening my tie.
Looks so good, but yeah, I'm gonna ditch this monkey suit as quick as possible. all right, Chris. Well, 234. We are cruising and heading out. All we're gonna finish out this year, and then, you know, we'll do the Christmas break, and then we'll come back with some fun shows. It sounds like, but we are like going to have more shows this year. This was just a very special dress up, get dressed up show. So. Chris, you got anything else? No?
I highly enjoyed it. I highly enjoyed it. Right. That's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. You can tweet about it on Twitter and follow us at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. And if you hate your t-shirt, head over to shoptalkshow.com/shop and get a brand new shirt. I think I've said it wrong for the last 10 episodes, but it's shop I learned today. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.